Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Novelist Amy Tan has a long list of bestsellers to her credit, including the one that made her famous, The Joy Luck Club. Her latest, The Valley of Amazement, is just out, and while it follows some familiar themes, it details the world of courtesan houses in Shanghai more than a century ago. It was inspired by an old photograph of her grandmother in China, which she displayed for an audience of several hundred of her fans at a St. Louis County Library event this past weekend. That's Amy Tan I'm speaking of. She was introduced by her friend, fellow novelist, and St. Louisan Ridley Pearson, who teased her about her performances as a dominatrix in their author celebrity band, The Rock Bottom Remainders. Ms. Tan talked on stage with me about her writing, her life, and her belief in ghosts.
I've seen ghosts actually several times, and I try to say, and you know, I can be a rational person and say that these are things that come out of your mind, out of a desire to see somebody who's passed, or. But there is one occasion that I saw my mother, and it was 24 hours after she had passed. You'd always think that a ghost would look kind of like a person, only filmy and wearing night clothes, but. She was actually just a face, and she looked like she was made out of a hologram of light. I was just sitting there staring, and she was coming toward me. What was really different from just seeing something, we could communicate with each other without words. And as she came closer, I felt more of this, that she was saying she was happy, but that love and peace and joy were the same thing. And at the point she would have touched me physically, I had such a hit of emotion, the most intense emotion I've ever had. Now, the reason why I also know I wasn't asleep, my little dog, who always stayed with me, never would run away, got off the bed, ran down the stairs where my husband was working, barked at him, and just in a very lassie-like mode, you know, was trying to go up the stairs, like, come on, come on. And he said, what happened? Did you see a ghost? And he went upstairs, and my husband saw me at that moment when I was looking. And then I was quiet, and after that I said, Lou, you'll never guess what happened. And he said, you saw your mother. And I said, yes. So the little dog went down there to prove I was not asleep.
Well, you do have a ghost cameo appearance in Valley of Amazement. Early on, but just a cameo appearance.
Yes, I always have ghosts, I think, in my stories. My mother thought that I saw ghosts from the age of 4, and it was because I told her a lie. She wanted me to go to bed. She said, brush your teeth, you know, wash your face, go to bed. And I said, well, I can't. I can't go to the bathroom. She said, why not? I said, because there's a ghost in there. And she said, really? And she took me over to the bathroom. I think most parents would turn on the light and assure the child that there was no ghost. But my mother turned on the light. She said, where is she? There were other times when she'd hear me say something. And she may not have thought that I was talking to the ghost. She thought I was a reincarnation of somebody who had died. So I grew up, you know, with this sensibility that ghosts were very much a possibility in our existence.
How does that work into your craft, do you think?
Well, there are two ways. One, they make an appearance actually in the story, and I think it's just, it naturally works in that there might be a ghost in the house or a presence of somebody, something felt. But also, there's a ghost that seems to help me in the writing of my books. I have this feeling since the beginning of writing fiction that my grandmother would be there giving me gifts. And the gifts would be in the form of coincidences, serendipitous bits of information. And I'll give you an example. And I can never ask for these. I can't say, Grandma, can you bring me this or that? But there was one time that I was writing about the excavation of Peking Man, and I thought, I wish I had more information about this. And I got a call that day. Would I like to come at the last minute to what is our favorite Chinese restaurant? They said they were honoring some archaeologists. I thought, how handy. So I went there. And not only were they honoring archaeologists. No, they were honoring only one. There were archaeologists there. They were honoring the man who led the Chinese team that discovered Peking Man.
Wow.
Okay, see, I have these coincidences, but they're so specific. There are others where the person, I need something about wind erosion. That night I'm sitting next to a geologist, and his specialty is wind erosion. You know, that's when I think they are gifts. And I remember thinking, well, this is coincidence. When you have a focus in your mind, sometimes it all funnels into what seems relevant. But then I hear this voice that says, how many do we have to do before you believe that? Now I have my mother. My mother passed, in 99, so I have her helping me out.
You better be careful about what you choose to write about if they're playing that big a role. Of course, something serendipitous is also very important to this latest book, isn't it? Dealing with your grandmother.
Yeah. The reason for the book has to do with this coincidence of finding a photograph of my that relates to my grandmother. And what I should do is tell you about the photograph of my grandmother that sits on my desk, my inspiration that I've been looking at throughout the writing of all my books. My grandmother, in about 1910, had a photo taken, and I just thought, well, was it taken for her wedding, or what was it? She's so beautiful. She has on this headband with pearls on it, embroidery, and it forms a V at the top of her forehead. It sort of pulls tight so that her eyes are slanted a little upwards. Her jacket is very tight. The collar goes up to just below the ear, the earlobe. And the sleeves are shorter than normal and tighter. And you see the white lining. You see matching bracelets and also very tight pants. And it is taken in what's known as a Western photo studio with pots of flowers. And the Western photo studio is characterized by these painted backdrops. I then found, while doing research for this novel, a photograph in a book, and it stopped my heart. It was a photo of 10 beauties of Shanghai, 1910, and five of these beauties were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother was wearing, the headband, the jacket, in a Western photo studio. And I looked at this, and I said, well, that was a popular fashion for its time, but now I read they were courtesans. I was stunned, and I started reading everything I could about these courtesans, and I found out the clothes were very particular. There was a very, the most popular of the courtesans had the same outfit on. And you can see, if you were to compare these outfits, headband to headband, jacket to jacket, it's the same. My question then was, why was she wearing this jacket, this outfit?
A question without an answer, just supposition.
Well, there were a few other photos that I found of my grandmother, and they were also, in that style that would have been what a courtesan would wear, and also in the Western photo studio. I contacted a number of academicians who specialize in this area, and they said, of all the details that you have here, it is the Western photo studio that is the most significant. But we all agreed we would not be able to say that she had been a courtesan any more than if Ridley were to show you a photo of me in my dominatrix outfit, that would be proof that I had been, a dominatrix. Exactly. So there could be many reasons, but there were a number of photos over the years.
I can't see the PowerPoint, but there are no pictures of Amy wearing this outfit, are there?
Yes.
Am I missing something? Tell us about the courtesan life. Your story takes place a few years after the turn of the century, the last century.
Yeah.
Tell us what courtesan life was like in Shanghai at this time.
Well, in Shanghai, there were first-class courtesans, second-class courtesans, and then in the sex trade, there was a continuum. And from there, it would be, say, women who took private clients in their home, flower opium houses where sex was part of the deal at the end of the night, streetwalkers and sex slaves who were little, often young girls. The first-class courtesan houses were very glamorous. They were like stars, pop stars. They designed their own clothes, and they often had Western details. They rode out in carriages. They had a lot of freedom. Young girls would see them as they passed by in the carriages, and they would faint at the sight of these courtesans. But their life was very short as a courtesan, from the age of maybe 15 until their early 20s. And then their career was over because there were so many other flowers waiting in their turn. And a courtesan then would have had to have their future set up by then. But these were teenage girls, and a lot of them, you know, they had the same passions as any teenage girl. They had to become very good businesswomen to secure a future.
Much of what you write focuses on the relationship between mothers and daughters. Why is that?
All of my books, I feel, have been about me in some way. But what I mean by that is self-identity. Who are we? How did we become this way? What part of our personality were we born with? And what are the influences? If we could have changed the influences, if I had had a different parent, who would I have become? If my father hadn't died, who would I have become? Well, the most important influence, I feel, has been my mother, and so she's naturally figured into my stories. Plenty of other things have figured in there as well, but she has always been a part of that. I keep thinking to myself as I start a new book, no more mothers and daughters. I'm going to do something else. But somehow she always manages to come back in there. You know, she was pushy in real life. Why not in literature? You know? Yeah. So.
But, you know, there's a line that one of your characters has in the book that I think is a most interesting line, and one I'd like you to discuss, and that is, accept love when it is offered.
Yeah.
Accept love when it is offered. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, it was kind of rejected.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the characteristics of these courtesans had to be setting aside their emotions. And there have been times in my life as well that you start to think what your defenses are going to be. My father and brother dying left me very defensive about accepting and trusting anything in the world, including love. So, you know, you end up pushing things away as protection. And at some point, you know, somebody very good says, accept love when it's offered. And it takes a different kind of trust to finally be able to do that.
You've really drawn on your family and family experience very heavily for this book, haven't you?
I have, but mostly in a thematic way. The storyline certainly is not about our family in any way. Because, for one thing, I didn't live during the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. There is an American there. That wasn't part of our life. But the thematic notions that are in there, for example, abandonment, are part of it. The story has a lot to do with abandonment, betrayal, trust, love, different kinds of love, and forgiveness. In my family, my mother was, in a way, abandoned by her mother because her mother killed herself. She was 9 years old, my mother, watching her mother die of an overdose of opium. And she wanted to fly off to heaven with her mother. She talked about that. The other abandonment that happened was my mother and her three daughters. When my mother came to the United States, she left behind three daughters. And it always troubled me. My mother would not feel guilty about it. There were circumstances, and I was the one who was always trying to actually find the good reason that she had to do that, that she did not know the U.S. and that the U.S. and China would close down relations, and she would not see them for the next 30 years. But that was a very traumatic abandonment. My sisters and I have talked about that. And I'm surprised that they aren't more angry or distrusting of love than they are.
Yeah. A different culture, a different attitude. It's throughout the book. I mean, I felt as a reader that I learned a lot about Chinese culture simply by reading it.
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of research for the book because I wanted to immerse myself in that period. Had my grandmother been a courtesan, I wanted to know what her life would have been like. What was Shanghai like during that time? I wanted to know Shanghai that my mother lived in. Popular culture to politically what was happening, entertainments, fashion, everything.
How often do you visit China? You were born here. I want to emphasize that you're born here. Yeah.
I started going to China in 87, which is fairly late, but I have gone back sometimes, once or twice a year. I haven't been able to go back recently. I haven't been there in a year. I guess it's been a year. I haven't been there in a year, and I won't be able to go for at least another half year. So.
How did they react to your celebrity?
Well, they're really proud, and I would think that no one would know me in China, but my books are translated there, and they happen to find everybody who knows about my books, so they're extremely proud. And they're proud of the stories. They're very proud if anything has reference to them. China is so different now. I was at a hotel, I would say 4 years ago, with Lisa Si. We were traveling. She was writing one of her books. We were doing research, and we had always wanted to travel together. We stayed at a hotel called The Mansion, and it was a place that had been the club of a gangster named Big Ear Du, who went to my mother's wedding. But that, off the point. This bellboy came to the room, and he had my luggage, and he turned over the tag, and he said, "Amy Tan." And I said, "Yes." And he looked, and he said, "The Amy Tan." And I said, "Yes." This is a Chinese bellhop we're talking about. And he said, "Amy Tan, the author?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I love Joy Luck Club." And I said, "You read my book?" And he says, "Of course." I said, "You read it in English?" He said, "Of course." I have never had a bellhop in the United States say that to me. This is a bellhop in China saying he's read my book. That is China today. It's a very surprising place.
Back with more from novelist Amy Tan in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We continue our conversation with novelist Amy Tan. We're talking about her new novel, Valley of Amazement, in a conversation recorded at the St. Louis County Library last Saturday.
People might be wondering about the Valley of Amazement, what that is. Can you, in a very general way, describe, because it pops up again and again for obvious reasons once you get into the book, but give our folks an idea of what that is.
Well, I was in Berlin at the National Gallery, a very quick tour, and I happened to see a painting. And I was very drawn to it because I couldn't tell what it was exactly. It was a valley, and there were mountains on the side. And it looked as though there was a storm brewing, or perhaps it was dissipating, that it was leaving. And the light was such that I thought maybe it was dusk. But then I thought, well, maybe it's dawn. And there was a figure, and I thought that the person was going into this valley, but then I thought, well, maybe the person is leaving it and looking back in reflection. And it was such an ambiguous feeling that it stayed with me. And I remember that the name of the painting was The Valley of Amazement. And there, I looked up later if there was a place called the Valley of Amazement. It's the sixth valley of seven. In a certain poem, it means the valley where you lose everything. You lose yourself, your sense of self, any sense of worth, and then you're ready for the valley of annihilation. So it seemed to be a very scary place to be. I thought about those times in my life where you reach a crossroad or a decision. It could be anything. It could be very exciting, going to college, getting married, deciding to publish a book. And something is going to happen that's going to change. And you don't know exactly what it is, but you're taking a step there. And that is that valley of amazement. It could be wonderful. And in fact, I found another use of the valley of amazement, and it is the wonder that you feel when you arrive there. That painting appears, and it has a major role in there, but it is more also the thematic sense of the crossword and the ambiguity and your own perspective in life that takes you into those situations and out of them again.
You worked on this book for 7 or 8 years, I think I read.
Yeah.
That seems like a long time.
Well, I worked on 2 books. The first book took 5 years, and it was quite different from this book. And during that time, I also wrote libretto for an opera, raised funds, did the publicity. That was a huge endeavor. I built a house from the ground up, an accessible house, planned everything, chose everything. That is like writing 3 books. I ended up trying to launch the career of a Parisian cabaret singer, and that was so that I would have something else to do besides write my book. Crazy things. And then I found the picture, and I decided I had to start my book over and write a different one. The setting that it opens with is in the beautiful place called Moon Pond, and that place is in this current novel.
Not a beautiful place, however.
Well, the illusion of the beautiful place. It's the valley, okay. And you see, okay. And you think that it's going to be, you don't know where you're going, and it's the beautiful place. In real life, the place I went to when I did research, it was a beautiful place. It was in the poorest, most remote province in China, a little minority village high in the hills, in the mountains, that it had a fire. And I went to visit a man who had been banished to a shed, his family, banished to a shed high in the mountains. And as I was walking to meet this person, I had to go along progressively narrower and narrower pathways that were dangerous. And at one point, I look over to the side, and it seemed if I lost my balance, I would land with my head down in the mud 20 feet below, and I would die. And so when you read this book, you will know when you get to a certain part with a pathway, you'll say, that's what she was seeing. That's what she did for the research for the book, and thank God she finished.
Yeah, you didn't get started at this, though, until you were 34, if I remember correctly.
Writing fiction. I was a business writer for a while. I was writing also grant proposals. I didn't start fiction writing until 33, 34, when I realized that I wasn't doing something that I truly loved. I was successful at business writing, but I didn't love it. I had lots of great clients, and that's probably what kept me going in there. And one day I decided that I had to do something for myself, and I would take either jazz piano or I'd read fiction and try to write stories, because I always loved to do that. And the stories went out. I went to a writer's workshop, and the things that were brought up there about stories and voice excited me so much. I knew I would do that the rest of my life, even if I didn't get published. But I did make a serious goal for myself, that I would not stop, and that my goal would be to get published in a good literary magazine like Grand Street or Paris Review by the time I was 70. So I have a few more years.
Your mother had a different path for you. She wanted you to be a musician. She wanted you to be a doctor.
First, a doctor.
But 15 years of piano studies, I understand.
Yeah. She wanted me to be a doctor and a concert pianist. She wanted me to be a brain surgeon, a neurosurgeon, because the brain was the most important organ, and to play the piano. And I've since met Chinese women who are both brain surgeons and who also are concert pianists on the side. I took 15 years of piano, but I knew from the start that I never had what it took to be a pianist.
And Carnegie Hall really frowns on concert pianists in dominatrix outfits, by the way.
Did that have anything
to do with it?
Well, that was my alternate musical career, saved by the rock bottom remainders.
How did that all come about? I mean, this guy over here, with his very generous introductions, by the way, Ridley, thank you. How do you get hooked up with these guys?
Well, the band was actually started by a woman named Kathy Kamen Goldmark, who was a media escort, took all of us around to our appointments. And everybody said, oh, you're so lucky you're in a band, because she was. And she decided one day she'd invite a bunch of authors, her favorite authors, to form a band, play at the bookseller convention just once for charity. And a number of us said yes, and those who didn't were very sorry later. They try to get in the band now. We won't say who they are, but among the people, Stephen King, Dave Barry, Barbara Kingsolver, a number of people who have come and gone, but the main ones, you know, have remained. And we called ourselves the Rock Bottom Remainders because, you know, those the most terrible kind of hell a writer can go to is when their books are slashed down to 99 cents on the remainder table. And the rock bottom ones are, you know, they're practically free.
So that's where the name comes
from. Yeah. And I have to say, our founder died last year of breast cancer, and we were so saddened. And it had been 20 years, and we said, well, it's about time. So we retired the show last year in front of the librarians, the American Librarian Association. But so many of us are on tour right now. We are all going to be at the Miami Book Fair. And so we're having our first, I think, annual reunion of the Rock Bottom Remainder.
I think I saw that you're playing together in November.
Yes, November 23rd.
What sort of music do you play? I know you play the tambourine among
yes, I play second tambourine.
Second tambourine.
hip movement. We play covers, and we have to play, except for some Dave Barry originals, but we have to play covers because we depend on people to know what we're playing. You know, and then they can sing along if they want. Often it's a 3-drink minimum. The band often plays to audiences who are about as old as we are, so they remember the music, they remember fondly those days. We have a very indulgent audience. We actually have, some of the people in the band have talent, are really good musicians, and Ridley is one of them. Ridley is a very good guitar player and singer. He has a lot of style. Dave Barry is really good. Mitch Albom, you know, he can do all this improv on the keyboards. Greg Iles is terrific. He's played in a band before. James McBride has been a professional musician, a sax player. We always make this joke that we are 3 chords and an attitude, and that we play as well. We play as well as Metallica writes novels. You know, all these jokes about how bad we are, and I am the truth in advertising. They have me because I really am the bad singer. You know, it would be terrible if they said they were really bad and they turned out to be good. Scott Turow and I drag the quality of the band down to an acceptable level.
Your second tambourine, who in the world is first?
That would be Mitch Albom's wife. Yeah, we used to have a joke where we'd say, oh, you think it's so easy to do this. Does anybody else in the audience want to come up and try to sing? And there'd be this woman, you know, me, please. We'd call this woman up, and then you'd say, well, what do you want to sing? She'd say, Respect by Aretha. And then she'd hit it out of the ballpark. And that was, she's a professional singer, Mitch Albom's wife, Janine.
The money raised all goes to charity. What charity
benefits
from
Yes,
this?
We have to say that. I beat Stephen King's butt for charity. So I have the whip at the end of my song. My song is, These Boots Are Made for Walking. And at the end, all the boys bend over, and I whip them. And that kind of thing raises $1 million for charity. The charities are for literacy, and actually, it's for we've done it for programs here in St. Louis that have to do with America Scores is one. They are for children's programs that foster literacy, cooperation, after-school programs, poetry. So all for a good cause. We have fun. The librarians who have supported us, they have fun. but also the kids.
What do you want folks in this audience to know about Valley of Amazement that would induce them to buy it and read it?
Well, I think of it as being very much like my other books in the sense of trying to discover, understand who we are. These are women who go through a journey that's quite different from the other books I've written. I do want to warn people that because it is a courtesan house, they are not playing Chinese checkers or ping pong. And that one of my editors, my early reader, said that you have to include something about what goes on there. So that is all public disclosure. We don't have to say what it is.
I believe the word is steamy.
Steamy.
I had to fan myself when I was reading. I want to tell you.
What I also wanted to show, though, it was not, there is love and there is some, you know, there are other things that happen in there that have to do with negotiation. And we are always negotiating in our lives to find what we need and what we desire. And these women had to negotiate and oftentimes decide what they had to give up of themselves or what their sense of selves and their respect and for the sake of having a future, for staying alive and not ending up in the gutter, as so many of them did. My grandmother was someone who ended up becoming the fourth wife to a rich man. And when she was 36, she killed herself. And I always wondered, what are all the circumstances that led to that?
We'll continue our conversation with novelist Amy Tan in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with novelist Amy Tan. This is a conversation we recorded last Saturday at the St. Louis County Library about her new book, The Valley of Amazement.
This is not 50 Shades of Grey by any stretch of the imagination, but it's fairly explicit. In some cases, is that difficult for you to write? Is it easy? Is it fun?
It was difficult for two reasons. One is that I've had so many people think that the stories I write are all autobiographical, that some part of it is autobiographical. And so I could imagine people saying, ooh, you know, that dominatrix outfit, wow, it's right in character. The other is that I was thinking of my grandmother, and she was the inspiration to our family. She was revered. She was known to be old-fashioned, quiet, traditional. And, of course, I found out she was not old-fashioned. But at the same time, I would not want to besmirch her in any way. And also in thinking about sex scenes, you know, I had a very hard time thinking that I might have been writing about her. So it was a little uncomfortable in that sense. On the other hand, I know this sounds like a joke. I did a lot of research for the sex scenes. I know. No, I didn't go to X-rated movies. I was reading about the just things like the aphrodisiacs of the time. There was one for men. It was known as happiness in the pavilion. Okay. Another was for women, gates wide open. There were positions that I read about in a pillow book, and you don't even have to describe what they are, and in fact it didn't describe it, but it was things like Phoenix flying over the oyster, you know. So there are all these the different information about positions and aphrodisiacs. I also read pornography of the time. It was a Chinese classic from the 1700s, and it was called Jinping Mei, or Plum in the Golden Vase, or the Lotus, the Golden Lotus. And when somebody said it was pornographic, I was reading it, and I thought, well, this isn't bad at all. This is very coy. And then I found out that I had the expurgated version, and I got the unexpurgated version, and that one was instructional. It was also a business. And so there is a difference in the novel between negotiated sex, and then love, you know, the intimacy that one has. And it was also for me to think about this nature of intimacy, especially with someone who's been damaged by betrayal and by loss of trust and hope. You know, what does intimacy mean to them? And that's also what I was writing about.
When all of this was done and all of the research and all aspects of this novel were done, what did you wind up thinking of your grandmother?
I felt that I had come to know her so much better. She became real. And it's because I thought of all the traits that my mother has that she gave to me, the ones that I pushed away that I still inherited, and that there was a reason why they were so strong, and realizing that she had to have received them from her mother. From having done the research, also in talking to my family, and having written this out, the kind of journey she might have experienced, I could feel that passage of her life to my mother and then to me. And it had a lot to do with determination.
I'm sure it did. Amy Tan, ladies and gentlemen, let's get some questions from the audience.
Thank you for coming to St. Louis. I was curious as to what your favorite part of writing a novel is, from the inspiration from the photo all the way to the book tour part. You know, is it getting the cover, the editor going, wow, this is awesome? What's your favorite part?
The favorite part is the beginning and coming up with the idea, which is very exciting. Another favorite part is the research. It's a little too much of a favorite because I can go into too much research. That's pure play to me. But the best part of the writing is when I head toward the end and there are things that are happening and it is just coming to me so quickly and I see what the story is about and what I'm feeling, and it's a race to the end. That is the absolute best part. I have an epiphany, a sudden deepening in my understanding of my life. And it's a very intense experience. Almost, you know, as intense as falling in love, as intense as that feeling of my mother coming to me. We writers or artists or composers, there's this fear that we won't have that come to us. You cannot command it to come. You can't predict when it's going to come, but when it does, it's the addiction that makes you want to do it over and over again.
Do you make yourself write for a specific amount of time each day or a certain number of words?
Oh, I'm bad. I'm very bad. There are lots of times when I don't have a specific hour and I, you know, I'm off playing with the dog or whatever. But when it is at that point where everything is flowing, then I do write most of the day and the night. I get up late, maybe about 10 or 11, and then I work until about 3 or 4 in the morning. My husband brings me meals 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner. I don't leave the room except to go to the bathroom. And that's about it.
You're a prisoner, in a sense, aren't you, to it?
A willing prisoner.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Question in the back.
Hi, thank you for coming to St. Louis. I just wanted to ask you, I'm taking a different turn here. I'm a big fan of yours and of the show Criminal Minds. And in their premiere this year, they used one of your quotes. And I was wondering how that worked and how you felt about that. And if you got to see the show and if you thought it portrayed your quote in a positive way.
You know, I've never seen that show. And it was somebody called attention to the quote. I think it was in Twitter. And I can't remember the quote that they used. Do you remember?
Who knows where inspiration comes from? Perhaps it arises from desperation. Perhaps it comes from the flukes of the universe, the kindness of the muses.
Ah, yes. And I wondered what that had to do with a criminal mind. But I could extrapolate, and I could see that, you know, we become very creative in anything we do. We are inspired by love and anger and passion. I've never seen that show. But I was honored. Actually, somebody told me that they use quotes from different people, living and dead, and they're often, you know, profound in the way they try to tie them in. I should see the show, but I've heard that it has a lot to do with murder or something, so I don't watch shows like that.
Maybe we should ask Ridley if he can interpret that for
us.
He'll describe it. He knows a little bit about such things.
Yeah.
Do we have another question back there?
Good evening. Thank you for coming. I missed you when you were in New York several years ago, so this is a huge treat for me. And you are gorgeous. How long did it take you to write The Joy Luck Club? And the second question, do you rewrite often the beginning of a chapter more than once? I've heard that authors do rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until they're satisfied with it. And then the third question, just because I'm curious, do you have any children?
Ah, okay. The Joy Luck Club, I wrote over a period of 2.5 years, but the first 2 years were the first three stories. I thought I was writing short stories. I had no idea that I would be publishing this as a book. And then there was a contract, and I was afraid that they would cancel the contract once they realized the mistake they had made. So I wrote the rest of it very quickly in a half a year. I would never be able to do that again, but I wrote in a, you know, in a state of panic. So 2.5 years. The other question had to do with what again? Revision. Revision, yes. I revise every time I open my file, and it's excessive. I probably revise every single page at least 100 times. I've had students say to me, well, I've revised this twice, and, you know, it's so frustrating, and I just, you know, don't lose heart. Don't be discouraged. Fortunately, I love revision, and that's probably why I shouldn't revise that much. What I should do is move ahead and keep doing the story and then go back and do big revisions over time, not every day. The children. I have a very, very sweet Yorkie who's a year old. I saw him on Skype video today playing, and I was able to remotely control him. Sit! You know? All my children live in my books, I don't have children, and that's by choice.
By the way, whatever you're doing with regard to your technique for revisions, keep it up.
Thank you.
I have a question back here.
Hi, I'm a high school English teacher, and so is my husband, and I teach in St. Louis Public Schools. And I was hoping you could give my kids, my students, a piece of advice, because I think they struggle, and I think what you said about teenagers is very touching. So I was hoping you could give them some advice.
Well, one is that if you ever get into trouble, your life is not now headed in that direction permanently. That's something that I believe when I got in a lot of trouble, when I got arrested. I thought my life is over. And I went on, as you can see, I'm here. The other is that it is good to have a friend, a very intimate friend called a book, and a journal. And you find the books that really speak to you, and it makes you feel a lot less lonely. Every single teenager feels lonely because none of us understand each other completely. And I think teenagers want to be understood. So finding a book that is your friend, and then keeping a journal. Writing down your feelings. It doesn't have to be, I feel sad. It could be, I saw leaves today, or I heard this today. Any little thing. And what happens that's so wonderful is that the following year you will read those remarks, those remarks you had in the journal to yourself, and that those words are your friend too. You're the same person, but you will have changed a little bit, and you'll be seeing other new things. I think it would be good if students also had other outlets and found a social way then to write more than 140 letters. But poetry seems to often be, you know, poetry slams, and kids like to get together and do that. So.
question over here to the side.
Hi, this is really exciting for me because I've been trying to actually bring you to my school. I go to Missouri State. So I've been actually saving this question for you for like 4 years. I'm really excited, if you can't tell. So I'm a first generation American Asian child, and I've been reading your books. It felt like you understood like what it's like to have that mother-daughter relationship that you don't exactly get along, and I'm still in that stage. How do you overcome it? Is my question.
You overcome it by getting older.
Perfect.
I think you overcome it also finding you have those same things in you that you just cannot stand when you were growing up. But there's understanding that comes, and I was lucky to be able to write about it and really think about it from her point of view. It didn't make her perfect. It just meant that I knew what her intentions were. And we see that there's something very different between actions and intentions. The intentions are in the stories, and if we can find the stories that help unravel what they are, then it happens more quickly. That kind of humor, I think, that happens also when you look back at what you hated at one point and now what you treasure.
And also back on this side, yes.
Hi, Amy. I wonder if you read fiction, and if so, what authors do you enjoy?
I do. Of course, I read fiction. One of the books that I am reading now, I'm just starting, is a book that will be out in February, and it's by a writer named Rabi Alameddine, and he's a Lebanese-American writer. The New York Times asked me, who do you think is one of the most underappreciated writers in America? And I said Rabi Alameddine. He writes about important things. He's got gorgeous prose. He writes stories that are fantastical but very serious, stories that illuminate what's happening in our country as well as the Middle East. And so the book coming out is An Unnecessary Woman, and it has received acclaim from Michael Chabon and Colm Tobin, from Alexander Heman. So you can see many great writers also think he is a great writer, and I highly recommend you read his books.
We have our final question here in the center.
Hi, you spoke briefly about a pivotal moment in your career. I wonder if you would expand on that just a little bit.
A pivotal moment in my career before, when I was a business writer? I was writing about 90 hours a week, 90 billable hours a week business. I was a successful business writer, but I was getting no sleep, and I was becoming increasingly unhappy. And people said, you are a workaholic. And I said, no, I'm not. I don't enjoy what I do. They said, that's why you're a workaholic. You can't stop, even though you don't enjoy it. And I went to a psychiatrist. For only a brief amount of time, he was very, very good because he fell asleep 3 times. And that made me think I was both very boring and I should get out of psychiatry. And I started to write fiction. I had always been a reader. I had always written long fictional letters to friends because we moved every year. And now I decided this was what I wanted to devote my life to, and I would continue to do the other part of it, the other business writing, to make a living, because I was a very practical person. But I could also then go to wherever I wanted with the fiction, and it was only for myself. I said to myself, don't even think about getting published. It won't happen. Just do it for yourself.
Thanks very much to novelist Amy Tan, and good luck with her book, The Valley of Amazement. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the issues raised in a documentary examining the continued plagiarism of Jason Blair while he was a reporter with the New York Times. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.